I absolutely loved it. That's one of my favorite parts is that after I read, okay, this is me at least, after you read it as almost like a novel, even though it's nonfiction, then it was like how in when I read a novel and when I even, you know, write a novel, people always email me or readers come up to me and they say, okay, so after I read it, I went and I Googled all this research about all the things, all the historical facts you have in this novel. And I love that. And I'm like, me too. That's what I do. I read a novel and then I go and I research all the background of it. And you have given it to us, though. Like, it's like you read it like a novel and then at the very back, you have, I don't even know, was it 100 and something, 200 pages of then
it's a lot.
The
it's a
information
lot.
That I don't have to go Google because it's right there. And now then you get to almost reread it through the notes and find all the little nuggets in there. This is a party book. Like, I had so much fun.
That's a good way to describe it. I love that.
It was so interactive for a reader on not just a reading level, but then on a knowledge level and on a learning level. And you felt like you were flipping back and forth even after you were already done reading it. I just think it's such a great book. And it makes the book not just what it is, but it makes it an activity. I found it at least to be almost like an activity, and I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, I know when I read nonfiction and I read a fact where somebody says something quite outstanding, and I'll be like, where did they find that? And I'll immediately go back and check the footnotes and see. So I'm glad to provide that service for anyone who's curious about the provenance of information.
Yeah, and that's why I am also plugging this as a huge book club favorite. Like, I'm just going to say it out there. Book clubs will love reading this because, like I said, it reads like a novel, but it's real. And then afterwards, everyone can get together and dig into the notes and have discussions about the, you know, what really happened and the history of it. And I just think it is such... It's good. It's my pick for the summer. Even though the summer's almost over, so I'll call fall.
I'm happy to Skype into book clubs. If any book clubs are out there listening, happy to join you by Skype. Or if I'm in the neighborhood, if you give me a cocktail, I'll show up.
Absolutely love that. Okay, you all heard it right here. She will Skype with your book club. So get in touch with her. And trust me, knowing you, Abbott, you will. You're not just you. When you see her on Skype or you talk to her in person, readers, you are just like, you're like a movie star of the book world. You're gorgeous.
Oh my God, you're so funny.
It's so true. So then you're mesmerized because you're thinking, oh, just tell me more historical facts, Abbott.
I'll take it. I mean,
you're
very kind, but I'll take it.
Well, it's very true. I'm not blowing smoke around at all. So now, I also wanted to talk about the connection to a novel that is a favorite out there. Speaking of book clubs, and I said summer, my summer pick, but I'm realizing my brain is pickled clearly still from being in the UK all summer because summer's just about done. So this is the fall. This is very much of I can feel it like doing really well with fall book clubs and school groups because, I mean, even though... We understand there are things in this that maybe aren't for young school groups, but I feel like university schools, students and such. But can you talk to us about the connection between this book and school favorite F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby?
Yeah, you know, I was really intrigued by this. There were all of these apocryphal stories that George Remus and F. Scott Fitzgerald met when the latter was stationed in Louisville during his military service. And, you know, there are apocryphal stories. There's no hard evidence that they met. But I think it's very clear that by the time Fitzgerald began drafting The Great Gatsby, the entire world knew who George Remus was. Fitzgerald certainly knew who George Remus was. And the similarities between Jay Gatsby and George Remus are conspicuous. You know, both lived in an opulent mansion, both threw lavish parties, both were obsessed with an enigmatic woman, both owned a string of pharmacies for their bootlegging purposes. And both, you know, as Fitzgerald wrote in the Gatsby about Jay Gatsby, he sprang from a platonic conception of himself. Basically that, you know, Gatsby and Remus if you want to compare them in this regard, too. Both really long to belong to a world that wouldn't have them. You know, they long to belong to something that wasn't quite a right fit. And I think that sort of melancholy is behind each of their stories, too.
And I think when you know or believe, I guess we should say, when you choose to believe that Jay Gatsby was inspired by Remus, it actually, at least for me, it softens his character. Like, he's not just a bootlegger who was, you know, doing these illegal things and, you know, he isn't as gritty anymore. He's like, it softens him. It makes me feel
they actually,
for him.
Some people called him the gentleman gangster. And I think that the other reason people really equate Gatsby with Remus was the parties. If I could just, if you could indulge me, I'll just describe some of these parties. So, well, Remus and his second wife, Imogene, who is a big figure in the book, bought this mansion in the wealthiest neighborhood in Cincinnati, and they had a grand idea of becoming social, this sort of the toast of the social scene in Cincinnati and beyond. And they were legendary parties, and one in particular was a New Year's Eve party in 1921. They invited society and journalists and captains of industry and robber barons to all come to their mansion. And Remus gave out these incredible party favors. He gave out diamond sextants and engraved watches for the men. Every woman got a brand new 1922 automobile. There were $1,000 bills tucked under everybody's dinner plate. And a gesture that was emblematic of the times and that would be remembered with all decades later, Remus lit guest cigars with $100 bills. And it's just astonishing to think that this is in an era when the average annual salary was about $1,300.
Right. That is insane. I'm wondering, too, how many party guests were there? Like, six or seven.
The highlight of the party was the unveiling of his brand new pool, which he called the Imogene Bath in honor of his wife. It was a heated pool, which was a crazy luxury for the time. And they even had electric baths, which, as I researched and found out, that these were sort of an early version of a tanning bed. They were heated with incandescent lights and said to make the user frisky.
Oh, my gosh.
So a lot of fun. I wish I could go back in time and attend one of Remus's parties.
That is really interesting. It's really interesting, you know, because it sounds like a novel. It sounds like, no, this is all made up. And yet, no.
It is stranger than fiction. I, in fact, don't think it would work as a novel because it's a strange story.
I'm thinking
especially the love triangle that develops.
Yes. And let's go right into that let's talk about the women because the foils for Remus were my favorite part of this. The mighty Mabel Walker Willebrandt and then his own wife, Imogene Holmes. So let's start with, which one do you want to start with?
Start with Willebrandt.
Okay.
We can start with Willebrandt. Willebrandt was a fascinating character. She was also in Boardwalk Empire as Esther Randolph, if anybody remembers her. She was in 1921 when President Warren Harding appointed her to be the Assistant Attorney General of the United States. Women had only had the right to vote in America for 9 months. If you can imagine, she's the most powerful woman in the country. And she was 32 years old, only 5 years out of law school, and had never prosecuted a single case in her entire career. And suddenly she's in charge of all of these prohibition cases, thousands of them across the country, including cases against George Remus. And to add to the pressure, she was almost nearly deaf and, you know, spent an hour each morning arranging her hair over her hearing aids. And also, you can imagine the sexism she had to combat being a woman in this job, especially a young woman. And on to Imogene Remus. She met Remus when she was a dust girl in his law office in Chicago, basically the cleaning lady. They hit it off. They divorced their first spouses.
Wasn't she the second wife of his?
Yes, his
right?
second wife.
Okay.
Yes. And they hit it off and decided to divorce their spouses and move to Cincinnati together. And I think that, you know, she was well aware that Remus was a brilliant man and he was poised to make millions of dollars as a bootlegger. And Remus really fell in love with her. He respected her. He sought her advice on business decisions. He actually called her prime minister. Imogene, on the other hand, only had one nickname for Remus, which was Daddy.
Oh, my.
And her intentions were probably a little bit less honorable. She confided to a friend that she wanted to, quote, roll Remus for his role.
Oh, my. So. Well, at least I guess she was honest about her intentions there, right? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.